Tomb Raider gets rebooted for the first time, carnivorous space critters threaten Kansas, and hot 90s bands take us to school. This week on 30-2010.
30-2010, here we go again. Analyzing decades, sitting with our friends, those with different days. And there's so much to say.
Welcome back to a new episode of 30-2010. This is covering the week of April 8th through the 14th. And in every episode, we look back at what happened this very week 30 years ago, 20 years ago, and 10 years ago. That means 1986, 1996, and 2006, should you somehow have nostalgia for that period of time. I'm sure some of you do.
It's almost ready for that.
I'm one of your hosts, Brett Elston.
Chris Adesta, trying to think about anything from 2006 that isn't The Office and The Departed.
Jose Chung's Henry Gilbert.
Ooh, and Anna Goodman.
And taking a nice sip of my Arizona Soda Shack. If you want to sponsor the show, I'm listening.
Please, Arizona and Shaquille O'Neal.
I'm sure Shaquille O'Neal has lots of things to think about in 1996.
He seems to be sponsoring every YouTube video I watch.
Yeah.
Why not this show?
Well,
and
yeah,
you may hear him at the beginning or ends of several of our clips. We always start our show looking at 1986. Again, we begin with a little...
What week is this?
This is the 8th through the 14th.
Oh.
And we will begin with a bit of news. I did not live in California until 2005. After you move here, you definitely know this bit of trivia. And if you were old enough, I was only 5 years old when this happened. But this is a great piece of history.
Results from Carmel, California. Clint Eastwood is mayor by a landslide.
The campaigning is very difficult, I must say. It's much more difficult than making a movie.
Oh. But Clint Eastwood becomes mayor of Carmel by the Sea in California, a beautiful tiny town that I went to in 2006. Oh my God, that was 10 years ago.
He rode that crest all the way to yelling at a chair at the RNC convention.
I don't care about his political leanings or whatever. I love Clint Eastwood. He's great. Like, he is old Hollywood.
See, Clint Eastwood reminded me of this year at the Oscars, what Sly Stallone kind of is now. Like, a guy who was ubiquitous in movies but never appreciated or awarded with anything.
Mm-hmm.
And then we make fun of him, and then we kind of like, oh yeah, you were awesome and there for us the whole time.
Well, yeah, and
you deserve an award.
And he invented Gran Turismo.
And
I can't believe
that. Clint Eastwood wins an award like every year for no reason.
Well, I believe it was a big... I actually read this piece from before Unforgiven won all those Oscars, that it was a piece about, is it time for Clint Eastwood to finally win Oscars? Because he had been on the outside. He had, as he told it, he hosted the Oscars 1 year, and it was such a horrible experience, and he made no bones about hating it, that then the Oscars were like, well, F you too then, buddy. You don't win any.
And, he also wasn't making a lot of movies that were that
any which way but loose.
Wait, Misty for Me?
Yeah, that's a good movie. I like
Bird. I've never
that's
seen Bird.
A pretty good movie too.
Yeah. He's also a prolific filmmaker. He's made 8 million movies. Some he stars in, some he doesn't. And he's also famous as a director who is like a one-take dude who's like, whatever, it was good.
Get a fake baby in there. I don't care.
One of my favorite stories about his directing style was he directed Scatman Crothers in a movie. Mm-hmm. And he did one take with him. And Scatman Crothers had, not long before that, worked on The Shining, where he was broken by Stanley Kubrick. And then he does one take with Clint Eastwood, and Eastwood's like, and we're done. Cool, moving on. And Scatman Crothers said he cried. He was like, only one scene, we're done?
Yeah, preparing himself for so much pain.
Yeah.
Speaking of movies, as we are wont to do on this show, this week, April 8th through the 14th, Money Pit is number one.
Jesus.
I think this is the first week
bounced back.
Yeah, I think this happened.
Now.
I think it debuted not at number one because of Police Academy 3.
It's too strong.
And then now it's finally churning up to the top. Which is the opposite message of the movie. turns out the movie was not a Buddy Pitt. Doesn't matter.
Yeah, it was.
And then, so the release date on this is questionable because I see like just 1986, and then sometimes it shows April 86. But Dr. Otto and the Riddle of the Gloom Beam which yeah. is the first movie, I believe, to actually star Jim Varney slash Ernest in a role in a movie. Mm-hmm. This is pre-Ernest Goes to Camp. This is before Ernest like blew up as a theater
wow.
thing.
There's still commercials.
I was positive this was Room with a View. I'm surprised. Can we get to that one later? Or?
Yeah. Yes. Well, I mean, if I can fit it in.
But Jim Varney.
I'm not even going to start with Jim Varney and Ernest because that there will
if you
be.
Don't know Elson. He is a big Ernest fan.
I am the world's only Ernest hipster.
What are you talking about?
Not the only. He's the only hipster. Chris.
Movies I don't even care for. Like, if it's like, oh, Goes to Camp.
The commercial outtakes. The commercials. The Splash Mountain promos.
The commercials. The movies are fine, and Jail is still kind of fun and silly, and I saw it as a drive-in as a kid, so, like, I do have fond memories of the movies, but just the story of what John Cherry, Jim Varney, what they did and how they became so big through, like, practically handheld camera shots in their own homes.
Hyper independent, self-made.
And convincing people like Coke and Disney to pay them a ton of money to shoot shit in their house and just hawk the same products over and over again. And you just take a Mellow Yellow can out and move a regional thing in, and now it's a commercial for Georgia. Like, it's
Ernest, owned by a milk company.
Well, like Purity. Look.
This isn't the Ernest history show.
We will do it.
But what is this?
Dr. Otto is a movie that's just it's this other character he plays where there's like a hand on his head that moves around.
It was his Dr. Doom type character, a world conquering cartoonish supervillain.
Yeah.
Have you seen this?
I've seen it.
I saw it once as a kid and was like, this isn't Ernest, so I don't care.
So the cover, the cover implies it is an Ernest movie, recall the VHS, because they released it on VHS after Ernest is huge thanks to Goes to Camp. And technically, Ernest is in the film, barely, but it really is a very lo-fi film of all these first-person testimonials and Jim Varney showing off all the characters he plays, including Dr. Gloom.
The old lady? What's her name?
There's an alternate reality where he could have been Jim Carrey. Like, he is that malleable with the goofy shit he can do. I think it's just his Kentucky Midwestern drawl is, like, so dense.
Yeah. I mean, he became his only character. It's like Pee-wee Herman. Yeah, Pee-wee Herman was an improviser and a great comedian in lots of ways, but set into his character in some ways.
Paul Rubens.
Paul Rubens.
I mean, that's the same thing, and I always joke, like, I'm so sad that in this age of crossovers...
They would have done a movie.
Ernest and Pee-wee would have met by now, and it would have been my favorite thing that ever happened on planet Earth.
You'd be losing your mind. They'd be in every Super Bowl commercial together.
Pee-wee, we gotta get...
It's just too bad
we're all out of Dr. Pepper!
It's just too bad that Jim Varney's vices were a little more destructive than Pee-wee
Herman's.
His
quote on his E! True Hollywood Story, part Irish, part Cherokee, he takes a drag off a cigarette and drinks from whiskey. What choice do I have? What? Dead at, and I just grew a year older, and I look and like I can't believe how young Jim Varney died.
Yeah,
and how close I'm getting to
it. He wasn't that old. 50. And mostly known. A lot of people would know him as he was the voice of Slinky Dog in Toy Story right up until the minute he died.
Yeah, in the first two, he also I remember.
So when Slinky Dog says, "Golly, Bob, howdy," Ernest Jim Varney was saying that in the 80s, and he got that from like his grandpa or something.
Also that he I remember a story from him working on The Simpsons that. He was the Carney on the Carney episode.
Yes, Martin Carney.
Grifters.
And the Grifters / Carneys, whatever. But when he was filming, when he ended his recording, he was going to go to Korea for Ernest stuff. He's like, I don't know. Koreans love Ernest. The weird twist at the end of the Dr. Otto movie is that Ernest is the last dude you see. Dr. Otto has been stopped from taking over the world. You see Ernest last, and then he, in a very un-Ernest move, takes off his hat and reveals that he had the hand on his head the whole time that Dr. Otto had.
The timing of the movie would mean that, like, Jim Varney had made a bunch of money as the Ernest character
with Ernest
those commercials, and he's like, I want to make a movie with this with our company.
Yeah. Well, he always had wanted to be an actor. Yeah. He was always on stage as a teen and as a young adult. Like he wanted to be
a really
an actor.
Good actor. If you see him in the rare occasion when he's not Ernest or Jed Clampett,
you can find YouTube clips of him doing Shakespeare and stuff.
He played a very rich British dude on Roseanne. Remember, he was one the suitors for Roseanne's sister.
Yeah, man, I got to check that out. Well, we're not going to talk about that though.
Whoops.
I really didn't want to talk about Ernest at all, and we still did.
My mistake.
No. It's good. Any chance that I can? There's also a great book out called "The Importance of Being Ernest." That is just a biography of his life and like telling how he grew up and the acting that he went through and going back and forth between Hollywood, New York, and back to Tennessee, Kentucky. Like, it's a good book, and if you want to read it, you should. Mm-hmm. And then also John Cherry had a book, and I forget the name of that. Keeper the Clown. And again, it's just I don't know. That's the story.
Yeah, let's move on.
It's a fascinating story that we'll do a whole later time about. Mm-hmm. Money Pit's still number one, but the big movie this week that we should probably talk about.
Again,
critters. They bite.
Sure that was Room with a View.
It's coming when you least expect it.
Critters. Surprisingly, I never ever saw. I confused them with the Ghoulies for years.
The boxes scared me too much on the VHS selves. I was like, it's too scary.
I was saying before we started, that it's a Gremlins ripoff. But you say that this was in production before.
Allegedly, the script for Critters was in production before Gremlins was released, and then after the movie, according to the wiki, after the movie, after Gremlins came out and was so popular, they tried to start rewriting pieces of Critters to make it look less like Gremlins. Such as the critters are from space.
Yeah,
they end up like
they break out of space jail, like
they're
the
in space
of the galaxy.
Jail, and then they land. Yeah, and then they land in Kansas, and they're just like tiny, like fuzzy porcupine razor, like piranha balls, basically, that fly around and eat shit, and then constantly breed more critters.
Tribbles with Boglin faces.
Yeah,
which is a terrible title for a noir book.
Carnivorous Tribblin.
The critters are not very marketable creatures,
but
compared to Gremlins.
They made four movies, and they're being brought back into a new web series.
Of course they
are. Unbelievable.
You will not believe.
But this is
why make a new thing when you could even just dig up fucking critters and make that?
But this is because Warner Brothers owns it now through their acquisition of New Line Cinema. New Line Cinema being a very, very independent and small production house at this point.
I mean, without Nightmare on Elm Street, they wouldn't exist.
I constantly confuse the critters for the Ghoulies, were it not for one special person, Raphael.
Oh, yeah.
The Ninja Turtle.
Ugh. Where did they come up with this stuff?
If you've seen the Ninja Turtles movie 1,000 times...
The 1990 Ninja Turtles movie.
Which, by the way, is New Line Cinema's breakthrough film.
That movie is awesome.
It's still considered one of the highest grossing independent films adjusted for inflation ever made.
Unbelievably, nobody wanted to make it. And so they had to, like... find the Chow, or like Raymond Chow, the Chinese production company, to give him some money to make it.
Really? What site is it? Is it Hollywood Reporter?
Hollywood Reporter did an oral history of it a couple of years ago.
Great. I love that movie as a kid, and I rewatched it in college and was expecting to like cringe along, and I was like, this is actually
it's a competent film. It's so weird. It's not what you'd think at all.
Yeah. And it's the only time they did independent Muppet production on it. Like Jim Henson did stuff for it, and it wasn't a Henson company
directed
production.
By the same director of the Aha Take on Me video.
And I believe it was Raph who was the only one who had the same voice and man inside.
The rest were
revoiced.
Everybody was meant to be swapped out, but they kept his.
I mean that's so good. Like,
but we don't talk
Jose Canseco back.
We'll talk about that in four years.
But yeah, Critters, a movie series from 86 to 92. You will not believe what the world's greatest critics of this era had to say about it.
You know, I like the film for the same reasons you did. Normally what we get are these creatures from outer space coming in, tearing up the people in planet Earth, and then fighting and see who wins. This film says, forget the people pretty much on planet Earth. Let the aliens fight it out themselves. They got these little bowling balls with teeth going, and these monsters going after them, the bounty hunters you call them. And that, for me, was kind of fun. We're sort of innocent bystanders to this whole action, which, if I were a teenager, I'd just ate up. And I enjoyed it as a double teenager.
I like the way the movie was able to go back and forth between what is obviously supposed to be a science fiction thriller and the other part, which is kind of a down-home comedy. Right.
They both loved Critters.
That's crazy.
That's Siskel and Ebert.
Siskel and Ebert. Two dead famous critics.
That description almost makes it like Attack the Block, kind of.
Yeah, it does, actually.
Yeah.
Or Mars Attacks.
Yeah, we just happen to be in the way.
But yeah,
maybe I'll give this a watch then. I don't know. It also reminds me of the MST3K episode Hobgoblins.
Because
I thought Hobgoblins was just a ripoff of Gremlins, but with the outer space aspect, that's more of a ripoff of Critters.
Yeah. It's the 80s.
Which Critters do you think is the one where they go to space?
Three.
Actually, no, Chris. Critters 3 takes place in planet Earth. But it was shot back-to-back Critter style with Critters 4, which does take place in space.
Just like Back to the Future, they shot it in the sequels. Yes.
And it stars Dee Wallace Stone, the mom from E.T., the first Critters, and M. Emmett Walsh.
Did she say somebody looks like a terrorist there?
World's finest purveyor of redneck guys.
Also out this week, Offbeat with Judge Reinhold as a librarian impersonating a cop.
Offbeat with Judge Reinhold!
Okay. I love Judge Reinhold.
Yeah, but...
But he has made no films people care about, I'd say.
Yeah. But, I did love reading the synopsis of this movie, though. Just the one sentence. This is... I already forgot his name.
Judge Reinhold
plays Joe Gower. Joe Gower is a likable librarian who glides around his job on roller skates. Just the, like, he rides around riding roller skates. This is an important character trait I had to get across in the synopsis. Roller skates. In the 80s, I guess, it was a big deal. Also, Violets Are Blue with Sissy Spacek and Kevin Kline.
Yeah,
I like
you're
those
looking
actors.
At me, and I love those actors, but I've
never heard of this.
Gothic with Gabriel Byrne.
Is Violets Are Blue a sequel?
Probably.
It sounds like a sequel.
Yeah, no, Gothic I have seen. That's a weird one because it's Ken Russell, and he's weird. But
he
sure
is.
It's Gabriel Byrne and Natasha Richardson and Julian Sands as Mary Wollstonecraft and Lord Byron and Percy Bysshe Shelley, and it's about them, like the basically the slumber party that created both Frankenstein and the vampire myth as we know it.
The wonderful sex party that created all those things.
Yeah, sex and drug parties that resulted
does
in
this
Byron and
does
Shelley.
Does this influence your 90s tabletop games at all?
To a degree, sure. But yeah, Byron and, well, it was Brian and
Byron
Shelley kind of had a thing of sharing Shelley of Mary.
Mrs. Shelley.
Yeah.
I guess they were kind of swingers.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Victorian age swingers. And so this was a film about that.
So the same party birthed both of those myths?
Yeah.
That's crazy. Yep.
Oh. Yeah, but they had this party and Mary Shelley ended up writing Frankenstein when she was like 18 or 19.
Wow.
And another guy at the party ended up writing, you know, The Vampire, which is basically, you know, where we got all the Dracula stuff.
Huh. Mm-hmm. Should I read Mary Shelley's Frankenstein?
It's good. It's really good.
Yeah
I've read it twice.
Finally, this week.
I think you mean a modern Prometheus.
The modern Prometheus, Hank? I know you haven't read it. Don't worry about it.
All right.
Get dunked, Gilbert. Go back to your tabletop games. Room with a View.
Finally. The best Ernest movie there was.
Yeah.
Helena Bonham Carter. She's 20 in this.
Really?
She is actually a lot older than we realize.
Man.
So, it's...
Don't reveal her age.
I know.
It's ruining her career.
Turning 50. Does she look 50? She don't
certainly
look 50.
Certainly not, no.
Not really.
Yeah, it's probably like the Merchant Ivory type movie in that it is super classy adaptation of an Anne Forrester novel about...
Briefly describe Merchant Ivory because it's not a word I hear thrown around.
I mean, that was a producer-director pair of Paragaze.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It turns out I didn't even know until I think Ivory passed away that they had been life partners.
Me neither.
It used to be a way to describe entire genres, Merchant Ivory.
Yeah, that they're really classy, really British adaptations of classic novels that are maybe a little more obscure. You know, you're not going to get like a Frankenstein. You're going to get like a E.M. Forrester novel,
or
Passage to India,
or the doily, the tea doily.
Yeah, there's going to be a lot of people being very proper at each other, and then maybe someone will be improper.
They're also they were expensive, right?
No, they were actually made for pretty cheap, you know, and like everyone like stayed in one giant house, and this, you know, they were
austere productions.
You know,
but
they'd pull costumes and stuff from like TV productions. They would shoot on location at places that really freaking look like this. I guess Remains of the Day is probably, I would say, their best known movie.
There's a lot of chased longing on there.
It's all chased longing. So that's what Room with a View is like. There's a lot of chased longing where Helena Bonham Carter and her mom are like on vacation in Italy, and they meet Julian Sands again, who is just in Gothic, two movies in one week.
Wow.
And he's like this passionate sort of poet guy, guy, and is it proper or not improper, whatever, and it's Italy, and she's supposed to marry Daniel Day-Lewis, who is, like, the most uptight guy wiener you have ever seen. It is so weird to see Daniel Day-Lewis super, super uptight.
Huh. And so Merchant Ivory became, like, a bad word at a time for some American, like, for some cinephiles I know, they were just like, Merchant Ivory, boring shit thing the last 3 hours. Like,
happens with any art tour makes the same thing over and over again. You say the same thing about Kevin Smith, but those are utterly unique movies that no one else makes and thoroughly entertaining.
Exactly. They're all really well made. I don't think I've seen a bad one. There probably is a bad Merchant Ivory movie out there. It's Merchant Ivory, by the way, James Merchant and Ismail Ivory. That's how the name.
Oh, man.
It sounds like Hanna-Barbera.
Wasn't Stevie Wonder and Paul McCartney?
But and also, I remember it became a bad word, like, in... When I think it was when Quentin Tarantino was starting to win awards for Reservoir Dogs, he was saying, "You see how something exciting can win an award and not this boring Merchant Ivory shit?" Like,
right, he was.
Well, it is the kind of thing Oscars freaking love. They make their money back, but it's not like no one's waiting around the block to see Howard's End.
No.
All right, I loved Howard's End, but. Come on.
And
man.
It took four...
It's not like... it's going to beat Jurassic Park this week.
Yeah. Well, it took 4 months for it to come to America. It was a December release in 85 in England.
Right.
And then it came out this week in America.
But it is a lovely film.
I only watch these movies on horseback.
I got to get... Well, I have to get someone to put me in a corset first, then I can watch it. Actually, I finally watched it maybe a year or two ago, and it's actually really nice. It's very... All the movies are very interesting and pleasant.
Television this week. Return to Mayberry.
A pretty boring time on television this week. But in 1986, everybody who's old and still living from the Andy Griffith Show got together for a reunion movie called Return to Mayberry. And
that's most
Ryan
of them, though, right?
Back and Barney too. With Gomer and Goober and Thelma Lou.
Old friend.
It's so good to see you.
They're all back for all new laughs.
I want to thank you all for coming.
In America's favorite hometown.
How come we ain't laid eyes on you lately, Cheer?
I've been out of town 20 years.
And they'll shoot the works when you return to Mayberry.
Slice in the fast lane.
And now join the celebration in a world premiere Sunday night movie.
Outstanding.
Can I say one thing? I love that Ron Howard is not ashamed of his old dumb TV stuff.
No way,
Remember, we just a couple weeks ago, he's got Gung Ho out in theaters making money. And he still will show up to Happy Days reunions and Mayberry reunions.
Yeah. And that he was happy to be, he was happy to be that character
wearing
again.
A hat, I'm guessing.
I mean, Andy Griffith's life is an amazing one. Yeah. He just got his start as like a comedian, a down home comedian. People loved his.
I think that's a testament to Don Knotts, who we vowed to bring up every episode. How funny he was that you forgot that Andy Griffith was the funny guy, and so did the writers.
Yeah, they hired him to be the funny guy, and then he was given a sidekick. They cast a young Don Knotts to play Deputy Barney Fife, who, like, got nipped this in the bud.
I can't believe how much of this show I watched.
I didn't watch any of it, but how grounded, like, the archetypes and names, like, Mayberry is a term for a podunk town. Barney Fife is a term for a bumbling white blue collar person. Otis is a name people used to use for a drunk. Opie is a name they used to use for like
children,
children.
Yeah, and same with like Goober and Gomer Pyle.
Totally, all of this stuff was like it was so ubiquitous in the zeitgeist, and I think only the last couple years fell out, like.
Yeah, I have no sense if like kids that are like 10 or
have
even
seen
20.
The show.
At
I remember
point,
the show.
Like,
I hated it, and it was unavoidable. It was on multiple channels.
Did you hate it because of what you thought it
was? I
was
bored by a black and white show about to start.
Totally.
It sounds like it's the most boring, anodyne, sanitized, white bread, mayonnaise sandwich show. And it is so funny.
It is so funny. I mean, it's almost kind of zen. This is going to sound very highfalutin, but it's almost zen in a way just how Andy Griffith is the one sane person around a town of kooky idiots, and he's a sheriff, and he never carries a gun. Like, he doesn't carry a gun. He just fixes their dumb problem. Meanwhile, Barney Fife's like, he's got to have his gun. He shoots himself in the foot in one episode, I recall. Like, he was the guy who's like, I got to be the tough, respectable sheriff. And then meanwhile, Andy's just come on, guys. Like,
growing up in a small town that was not unlike Mayberry, and surrounded by multiple towns that were not far off from that either, it was kind of just fun to watch. Zen-like is almost correct for me, because it was like this black and white, like, oh, I wonder what this was, what it was like before I was born. Mm-hmm. And just like people walking around the street saying hi to everybody. And even as a kid, I was super ADD and was already like, if it doesn't have a laser or a laser grid, I don't want to watch it. For some reason, I would just watch this and Lassie all the time.
Lassie, I didn't cotton, but this I watched
a lot. Too white bread for me, but
yeah, Lassie was not good, but it was just like it's a dog. Mm.
But yeah, I love the show. I remember seeing this Return to Mayberry once. It was a cute little bring back together. So the end of Mayberry kind of took over CBS, the Mayberry world, because it wasn't just his show. The show was so popular, it was spun off into like the Gomer Pyle show.
All I know about it.
Yeah, Gomer. Well, he joined the Marines.
He joined the Marines as Vietnam was starting.
Good idea.
And also, and then when Andy Griffith, like Don Knotts left the show before it was finished. Mm-hmm. When Andy Griffith left the show, they still wanted to keep it going. So they instead put him, like they made Mayberry RFD. They renamed it to that, recast the lead role. And or replaced him. They're like, we got a new sheriff. That went on for a few seasons. There was also technically Green Acres was related to the Mayberry. It was in the same chunk,
really?
But they weren't in Mayberry.
Wow.
But they had kind of crossovers because there was also the Junction show. What the Petticoat Junction, which was kind of the like bridge show between Mayberry and
what
Green
the
Acres.
Hell?
But then and there was Beverly Hillbillies.
Mayberry extended
as well.
Universe.
Yeah.
We were obsessed with Hayseeds.
Well, so it came to the point where CBS was known as the country broadcasting station because it had all these shows. And so then one year they cancel all of them. They're like, we got to shake this thing. We can't we can't be known as the country broadcast network. We got
to
be as hip
be
and
no
cool
PNN.
As all of them.
Which time is, to bring on Matlock.
And so this was the return to Mayberry. And like he was still on Matlock at the time, too. But here he was resuming his character of Andy Griffith in town.
Yeah. This is such serendipity. Mm-hmm. A callback earlier to a topic from earlier in the segment to what we're talking about right now.
Oh.
This is an actual commercial that was aired on television.
You know, I just got through watching the Andy Griffith Show on WDBJ 7. That's right, Vern. The Mayberry Sensation on your hometown station. I watch it every weekday afternoon. They got Aunt Bee and Barney and Goober and the whole gang. I know what, Vern. Let's me and you play Mayberry. I'll be Andy and you be Dopey.
He tries to walk out. Fishing gets caught on the ceiling. Can't quite get out the door. And then that's the...
Time just stopped. Like, what the... How did you do that? That was magic.
Because I've watched that clip at least 400 times in my life. Because it's on the VHS's The Ernest Greatest Hits Volume 1 and 2, where they collect all those commercials. But that's what they would do. It's like, yeah, we'll have Ernest come out. What do you want? A commercial for this local channel showing reruns of... Mayberry, what's the show called?
Andy Griffith Show.
Griffith wow. Show. Break for a second.
And he would just improvise
and
the
just
shit
come out and
something.
They'd have a basic idea of like, yeah, I'll just say Cotton and Goober and the whole guy. And then there's always one physical gag, which in this case the gag is he's carrying the fishing rod on his shoulder and it won't clear the door and it gets caught and he's like, and he can't get out of the scene. So,
Ernest.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
But yeah, man, I'm so glad I got to play that. Anyway, music taking us out for the 1986 segment. Rock Me Amadeus is still number one, but there's an important album released this week. Notorious, you could even say. Judas Priest Turbo.
Ooh.
Oh.
Notable for how not Judas Priest it was. So once again, when we have metal albums hit their anniversaries, I always talk to my friend Patrick Kulikowski, and he said... Turbo was and still is a pretty controversial album. After Defenders of the Faith in 1984, which was an amazing metal album that helped define Priest's 80s sound, they decided to experiment with synthesizers and made their song shorter, more radio-friendly, and poppy. The result is a pop-rock sound that a lot of longstanding fans were disappointed with. Mm-hmm. Priest looks back on the album not so much with negativity, but that in their defense, they were always about adapting their sound for the times and trying new things. The song
not
taking,
the last 30 years, but...
Yeah, so the song taking us out is called Turbo Lover.
Love it.
Please remember this is Judas Priest.
Yeah.
And when we come back, 1996, what happened this week, April 8th through the 14th.
I'm your turbo lover. Previously on Cape Crisis, Laser Time's comic book podcast.
Also, Dave, would you go on a cruise with Norman Reedus and Ernie Hudson?
Well, Meg got me thinking about Eve Horace. I'd rather go.
She hasn't been signed up yet for the Wizard World cruise, Dave. It is a con on a cruise ship. And
wow.
$700-ish dollars for a ticket. Well, Norman Reedus is the biggest name confirmed, and there's a lot of nobodies
Maybe
on there.
That means he dies on Walking Dead.
He's like, I'm free. I can go on a cruise all I want, baby. And Ernie Hudson is like, when he's the second billed guy on your crew, on like your celebrity cruise, like, you don't have a very strong showing on there.
Virgil from WWE, wrestling superstar.
That's Cape Crisis, the weekly comic book podcast only on the Laser Time Network. Check it out once a week, every Thursday or Friday.
What makes you sweat? Is it passion? Or could it just be heat? What about not knowing if your very next breath will be your last? What about all three? Tomb Raider from Eidos Interactive.
Not chic, you're hearing. That's Coolio.
Coolio?
One, two, three, four. Something new. Did not come out this week, but it is finally charting and like getting a lot of radio play. The album, Coolio's album, Gangsta's Paradise, came out in 1995. We actually talked about the Weird Al parody song of that, Amish Paradise, a few episodes ago.
I feel like I've said the word Coolio like 18 times into the mic in the last 2 weeks.
Well, we just watched the Daredevil with him not in it, and we still talked about Coolio. He's a compelling figure, Chris.
I guess.
He sang the theme song for Keenan and Kel's show.
Really?
Yep.
But yeah, the 1, 2, 3, 4 was just a fun song at the time, and the single was released in February, and then, yeah, around this time, April, it was finally like, I remember seeing the video a lot. I think the video has Jamie Foxx in it.
Mm-hmm. That's
like
believable.
That long ago. However, the most... Chris, you remember last episode we talked about, or 2 episodes ago we talked about Muppets Tonight?
Yeah.
And Kermit covered
Talking Heads.
So... Guess who is singing with Coolio on Muppets Tonight?
No.
Pepe!
Pepe rules. Everybody's wrong.
It is the exact same
the song
idea.
Is better.
And Coolio is there in person.
Of course he is.
And he's singing and dancing with the Muppets. I feel like he is surrounded by Muppets.
This is amazing.
But all the street Muppets.
So you're telling me no one on YouTube needs to edit Muppets rapping to this song? It's one song they want to do that with.
I just can't believe I never heard about Muppets Tonight. And like the 2 times I've looked at a song, it's like, oh, this is the greatest thing I've ever seen.
Yeah, because it's like, again, on our Facebook is the Kermit Talking Head song. It makes you wonder how they did the show, because it looks like they shot a music video, at least one music video every episode.
Something with a lot of time. Mm-hmm. Like
they did that on the Muppet Show. They did that too. Not as many camera cuts.
Yeah,
I'll admit.
Like
they were more stage productions with a single set or whatever.
Why is it not 1, 2, 3, 4? Get your Muppets on the floor.
I guess I could have listened to the rest of the song.
No, the Coolio. Well, Coolio.
Surely he works that in there.
Yeah, Coolio found a spot for himself as the clean rapper. Like I think he did have dirty rap songs until Dirty Rap. I sound like an 80-year-old
dirty
woman,
rap.
But to do Gangster's Paradise, famously, he could only sample, Stevie Wonder would only let him sample his song if he promised not to swear on it. And so he did, and that kind of caused this huge crossover exposure for him. It's how he became the Nickelodeon rapper, where the guy with the Muppets around him.
Yeah. Still out this week at number one is Because You Love Me, Celine Dion's song. It's been there for several weeks now.
God damn it.
New album from Stereolab. And yeah, Schoolhouse Rock rocks.
Yeah.
That has...
It's the return of your parents' nostalgia.
So all those Schoolhouse Rock songs that were already old when I was a kid, and I'm like, what
Quite
is...
I'm
what,
just a beer.
I'm just a beer. And that Simpsons would make fun of, but...
Junction, Junction.
Yes, Conjunction, Junction.
Function?
Here, only...
Migrant workers work for less wages. It's from the 70s, right?
They wouldn't sing about that, though.
Cesspool on the Potomac.
We're running out of energy.
The next big war will be for water. Schoolhouse Rock Rocks has covers from Better Than Ezra, Moby, Biz Markie, Ski-Lo, and here's Blind Melon singing Three is a Magic Number.
This is great.
Three, oh, it's a magic number.
It takes a while to kick in.
Yeah, but...
Blind Melon's awesome.
Let's jump
this
on.
This is the best song on the album.
Somewhere in that ancient...
So, Henry, you had this and listened
to it? Oh, yes. Yeah, I listened to it quite a lot. Well, it was kind of a sequel out. Well, not sequel, but it existed alongside the Saturday Morning Cartoons cover, which Chris and I both listened to, which had that had, like, Reverend Horton Heat and... who else is on?
I think the worst thing that I loved at the time was
Ramones
face to
on there. I think
Ramones
Spider-Man.
Was Spider-Man.
Yeah.
Face-to-face covering Popeye the Sailor Man.
Yeah, it was something.
Popeye Sailor Man.
So I love that one so much. So I was like, well, I got to get this other one. And I mean,
how is that okay? But Korn doing like Nightmare Before Christmas songs is not okay with you.
Because these guys dress in flannel and they don't look like they try hard, man. They're just like slackers or whatever. But you don't get me, man.
I guess.
So yeah, I listen to this all the time.
Wow.
And so the video you're watching sets the song to the old Schoolhouse Rock video.
Yeah.
And yeah.
I actually heard this song used in a major motion picture, the movie 2002 classic Slackers, starring one of the Peets and Devon Sawa.
So the Blind Melon cover in it?
Yeah, they used that song for a nice little montage of them like riding bikes together.
Because I think Blind Melon was done by 96, yeah, but they had this song, and I think maybe they got other people to do it. But though my favorite as a hipster, because I can't pick the most famous one, is my favorite, no sir.
Yeah.
My favorite song on it was Pavement's cover of No More Kings.
Taxation without representation.
And that's not fair!
This is amazing.
Throwing tea in the Boston Harbor.
Yeah.
Boston Tea Party. Thank you, Pavement. And here come the Bostonians with the pitchforks, throwing the redcoats into the water.
All right, anyway.
God,
I love that album.
Pavement horseshit.
I fucking love Pavement. I love their dumb shit. I love hearing Stephen Malkmus like half sing a song. I love that. If you guys, let me tell you a tip from your old friend Henry. Look up the albums, I'd say Slanted and Enchanted or Wowie Zowie of Pavement, both very good albums. Or if you're looking like Cut Your Hair, that's one of my favorite singles of theirs.
Crooked Rain,
yeah, that's the one that was on, yeah, too. And, God, yeah, there's too many good ones, but those are the three.
What was the original intention of, like, Schoolhouse Rock in the first place, was it 70s or 60s?
70s.
70s, it's probably part of that FCC ruling that part of children's television, 5% of children's television has to be put aside for
educational purposes. Because I guess I saw them on Saturday morning at some point, even in the late
80s. They did air into the mid-80s.
And it's like, how does a bill become a law? Well, let me tell you.
That's the most famous one.
Yeah.
And it, though they don't talk much about, you know, the lobbyists and stuff. And
right.
That, but
yeah.
No, they should add some more lines.
It was parodied like last year on SNL. Like, it was great.
It's so easy.
Bobby Moynihan is the bill. I'm an executive order, and I pretty much just happened.
I also remember in the Daily Show book, the first book, there's a bit in it where they wanted to have, they got real in it where they said, we wanted to license a picture of the bill guy, and they asked for an obscene amount of money. So we just asked this intern to draw a parody of it for free. Here it is.
During one of those election years, the Daily Show made an amazing Schoolhouse Rock parody with Stephen Colbert doing like all the voices. Singing, it's great.
And Conspiracy Theory Rock on TV Funhouse, if you remember, censored.
People are seeing that now because it was cut from all reruns.
Yep.
And never aired again.
It was good. But anyway, yeah, so this was musicians, cool dude musicians and girls of the 70s, growing up to then be asked to, could you just cover these things? We'll give you money. And
I just all I see is a giant sign that's flashing Gen X nostalgia, Gen X nostalgia.
It was not truly there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I was 15. Yeah, it was my freshman year of high school.
Well, I was in college, so it was aimed right at me.
But I knew it was cool to like what Gen X cool people like, so I liked it.
Got myself a bowling shirt.
Yeah.
Listening to some Schoolhouse Rock.
So, in again, with the sobering news in the 90s, because last episode we had at Genuine News in there. So this is an entire saga I'd never heard of, because again, I was freshman year, not plugged in the news. Like, I don't think any 15-year-old ever really is. So, but when reading this entire trial and the 10, 12 years it played across, 1996, this week, Daryl Cabey, civil trial against Bernard Boo.
Getz.
In 96?
Yeah, Bernard Getz. Yeah, 96.
Because the Bernard Getz subway shooting is
84.
Oh, my God.
According to the Billy Joel song, which is all I think of every time I hear it.
is that one of the things?
Yeah, Bernie Getz. I've been slowly ranking. By the time this comes out, I'll figure them out. What are the best band names you can mine from Billy Joel's We Didn't Start the Fire? The best one right now is British Politician Sex. That one is absolutely...
I've already seen one, the Space Monkey Mafia.
That's the other one I have.
Space Monkey Mafia. It's already been taken. I saw it. Sorry.
Bernard Getz is mentioned right before that.
Okay, so he
Gets AIDS politician.
Wow, Bernie Get AIDS. There you go. That's the band. But in 1984, he shot four guys who he thought were attempting to mug him on the New York subway. He seriously wounded all four, including like permanently paralyzing one.
Yep.
Despite being charged with attempted murder and assault, a jury eventually only convicted him of carrying an unlicensed firearm. He became this symbol of sort of vigilantism Well, this is also...
It was Death Wish come to life.
It was, but it was also, like, after New York had, like, Manhattan and New York had been dealing with the crime wave, and, like, 1990 was the murder capital of the country.
Yeah, I think that's the thing we lack when we look at it, what it was like to live in Manhattan in 84.
Even if you watch, again, it's going to be a sanitized version of it, but things like various movies that set there, it's exaggerated, like Ninja Turtles. It's like, how can the Foot Clan run around? It's like, because there's so many people getting stabbed and shot that, like...
And here's the difference between you and me. You think Ninja Turtles and I think Taxi Driver.
I know. Like, Scorsese has a very honest depiction of New York, a really shitty and, like, unwashed place.
Horrible. Yeah.
Like, oh, no, I mean, like, all kinds of movies we've watched that are, like street trash and all this stuff that's, like, New York falling apart.
Yeah.
And Double Dragon, when you look at Double Dragon 1 and 2, it's like, this is kind of just supposed to be New York where everything falling apart.
And there is a race component to it, too. Bernie Getz was white. The four people he shot were not.
But trump the idea that it is his right as an American to carry an unlicensed firearm and use it whenever he feels the need to.
Yeah,
that is his right as an American, Henry. You can't trump that.
But that's where all race factors. I was going to try to get through the whole synopsis before I even mentioned what race anyone was, because like when you just hear guys on the thing, he's carrying a gun.
It's a Trayvon Martin thing. Like,
and what if he had... Four guys try to mug him, and then he... doesn't kill them, he injures them all, and then turns himself into the police after a few days, and you're like, okay, well, this doesn't seem that strange, I guess. Like, it's aggressive and too much, but like, what? And it's like, well, it's a white guy that shot four black guys. Imagine if it was flipped. Different story entirely.
That guy wouldn't have got out of the subway alive. Yeah. Like, he would have.
So,
and in the defense of the four dudes, they said they were not about to. They said they weren't about to mug.
But
him.
So, like,
and he had previously been mugged, so he might have been a little PTSD, a little trigger happy.
Yeah, so
there.
Actually,
I wasn't defending Bernie Gex by. By saying remember the time, like the idea that like the public would be behind this person.
Yeah.
Well, they were
finally doing something.
Yeah, it's a weirder New York. It's the same thing you see with like a superhero arc trajectory, sadly.
Yeah. Well, it is supposed to be like, this is a synopsis from a news story. I think this is AP at the time that tries to summarize. This is before the civil trial, because the criminal trial, he only gets the unlicensed firearm that he bought because he couldn't get a gun after being mugged, and it permanently injured his chest or something. And so he was PTSD. He's like, I got mugged and beat up, and I'm going to carry a gun. You won't let me, so fine. I'll go buy one in Florida.
Yep.
And then he gets a gun. And then poor guys, whether they how far they got in the theoretical alleged mugging process doesn't matter, because he got spooked and shot him. But here's the synopsis.
There are many who believe that the Bernhard Getz shooting of four men on a subway 2.5 years ago was a tragedy waiting to happen. On one side, Bernhard Getz, previous mugging victim, a man determined never to be mugged or robbed again. A man who never left his apartment without carrying a loaded gun, an unlicensed loaded gun. Facing him, four young men, all with criminal records, on their way to break into video machines. What? Troy can't...
It was arcades, by the way.
He approaches Bernhard Goetz, asking for $5. Goetz says it wasn't the fear of robbery that scared him, but the look in Canty's eyes. From Goetz's confession to New York authorities.
I wanted to kill those guys. I wanted to maim those guys. I wanted to make them suffer in every way I could.
Holy shit.
Because he's like, if you're going to rob me, I'm the Punisher now.
No, that's a scary thing with dudes like that. It is like they...
Americans?
Yes. Well, I think they've all seen themselves as the John Wayne of their movie. Like, in same, that was most films of Death Wish in its revenge fantasy things of, I will go to a scary place, a scary part of town. The monsters that live here couldn't possibly not attack me, thus justifying my self-defense to murder them.
We have altered our revenge movie fantasies to where, like, everybody who gets murdered has a specific name and a reason and an origin story. Whereas, you're right, those movies of Death Wish is just like, this is just the closest street tough to you. Yeah. And the movie justifies itself by you putting bullets in his brain.
And they're just cartoons. Like, they're not people. Literally
Jeff Goldblum in a Jughead head. It is the craziest scene I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah. Okay, so we're 12 years later.
Yeah. So the civil trial.
Sorry, and these guys sue him.
They sue him, and they win to $40 million.
Wow.
Well, plus million.
They're not
which,
getting a dime of it.
Yeah, gets filed for bankruptcy. And later, like, he, you know, in the interviews he's done since then, he's just like, I don't know if I've ever paid any of that money. Yeah.
Nope.
Right. I mean, $40 million from a guy who rides the subway. Like, you're not going to get $40 million.
He was everywhere though.
Yep.
Like, yeah, a lot of media appearances.
Well, in general, with civil trials, even though people are given a number, like if it's against somebody like, say, O.J. Simpson, they know how to protect themselves from not having to give money.
Couldn't touch Bernie Goetz's NFL pension.
No, I mean, and it was. Bernie Goetz just became like a topic of for racist people and for liberal gun haters to just both use him as like, oh, this is the thing, you can't have another Bernie Goetz. We need another Bernie Goetz. Like, all these types of
things. That is so sad. Replace that with like Spider-Man or Batman in any movie you've ever seen, and that argument still happens.
Movies this week.
Gross.
Fear.
Fatal Attraction for Teens, as it was called at the time.
What?
Yeah.
Wahlberg.
Macky
Mac. Go Sox.
Mark Wahlberg, who was, I guess he was in his career ascendance here. He was not so far removed from being with the Funky Bunch, but
He
wasn't quite Boogie Nights. And then at the same time, he's in this teen, you know, B movie, pretty
Maybe
much.
You should take me, okay?
Maybe. Where he's the scary boyfriend of Reese Witherspoon.
Yeah, which I remember being sold as a William Peterson movie.
Really?
Oh, yeah, it's versus her dad.
Yeah, it's versus the dad. Like, I didn't even know Reese Witherspoon was in it for ages. Because it's just like, get away from my daughter. I'm being scary.
You love her, all right?
Yeah. Now he carves what's her name forever in him. And I thought that was
It
funny.
Always looked to me like a Lifetime movie.
Yeah, it totally is.
That MTV couldn't air.
I only remember it for a reference on Always Sunny in Philadelphia, where this girl who turned down one of the gang's advances starts slowly punching herself in the chest to make a bruise appear, just as Mark Wahlberg scarily does in Fear, to then get the cops and says that he was attacked.
Perhaps most famously for us, for me at least...
Yeah!
Bush's Machine Head.
We went looking this up because this is how I remembered it.
The single did come out this week.
The single came out to promote the film, and the music video is riddled with Wahlberg. It looks like, in hindsight, they just edited out the Fear content from the music video, and it's just a dude on a motorcycle.
I mean, it was, I would say within 3 weeks, it was more famous than Fear than...
Yeah. This is inarguably the best Bush song.
I love this song. This is
it makes no sense.
Yeah, this album, 16 Stone, came out like over a year earlier. This is the last single from that. Yeah. Like, this is after Glycerine. And,
I went to see Bill Cosby and the Florida Gators cut it together with Nirvana's Territorial Pissings. Like, them winning. Like,
wow.
This is a great song. This is just a weird tonally performance in general.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'll show you.
All right. Exhaust.
But also this week, James and the Giant Peach.
Dude, this movie is great.
I've never seen this somehow.
So this is
I saw it in theaters.
I came off so high off of Nightmare Before Christmas. I remember seeing trailers for this, and like, oh cool, I have to go see this, and I never did.
You didn't see it? Is it didn't have Burton's name all over it?
And I didn't care about that when I was this
age. I mean that was a huge thing. They still call it Tim Burton's Nightmare Before Christmas. I know, even though it's directed by Henry Selick, the guy who directed this
and Monkey Bone.
Yes, Tim Burton made another stop motion film. It sucks.
Yeah, Corpse
Henry Selick made a bunch of great ones.
Yeah. No, but like that wasn't part of my decision making. Like, I
just saying. No one gives it James and the Giant Peach any love because it was like this weird thing before Henry Selick formed his own studio. What's it called?
Leica
Studios, and still working with Disney, and it's really dark, and it's kind of scary, and it's as dark as Night Before Christmas, but beautiful and bright with live action people.
Well, it is dark because it's based on a Roald Dahl book, which means dark poverty, dark English poverty is at the center of it.
Really good. Richard Dreyfuss isn't it?
Roald Dahl wrote Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
What's her name? Patsy?
Play the trailer here, and I will scrub through it judiciously and edit this after the fact if it gets boring.
From Walt Disney Pictures.
Hop on, James!
Comes the wildest.
Holy shipwreck!
Whoa!
The weirdest.
You enormous bugs!
Fascinating, isn't it? Most exciting motion picture adventure of the year.
He's gonna cut me in half! Let's get out of here!
So you like
James and the Giant Peach.
Yeah. You like screaming characters? Richard Dreyfuss in this film. That is him, and you can barely tell because he's just constantly screaming.
No, it was... I think I need
to watch this.
I did enjoy it, but I think as a kid I was disappointed that it wasn't fully animated. It was one of those, let's go to Oz. Like, it's like, okay, real time, and now we're going to Oz.
Yeah, wait, are there real people in this movie?
Yeah, there's real people in the movie.
Big thumbs down.
But hold on. It's as live action as Wizard of Oz is black and white.
Right, yeah. Okay.
Like, yeah. There's a little more live action than...
Yeah, I feel like one of its problems is it's not Disney cute.
Yeah, it's not at all. Sure. I don't know why they made it.
Yeah.
It doesn't make any sense.
I don't know if they made it. Did they just distribute
it?
Maybe
just distributed it. I don't know.
Allied Filmmakers was
Everyone is, you know, it's... Yeah, everyone looks that little bit off-putting, kind of like Nightmare Before Christmas does.
And if you look at that...
You know, and some of the bugs are a little bit scary.
Yeah.
And,
but if you look at it next to, like, Box Trolls, like, it makes total sense.
Oh, yeah.
Box Trolls, which is wonderful.
I don't think I saw that either.
It's good.
We're going into TV, which
is a huge...
Like, the idea that these... I mean, one of these I don't really remember, but two of the episodes that we're about to talk about, the idea that they were on the same network... And in the same week is nuts to me because these lived on for years afterwards as probably among the most famous episodes of these shows.
2 days separated. So on April 12th, we had X-Files, Jose Chung's From Outer Space.
Yay.
The Charles Nelson Reilly episode, one of the weirdest, best episodes.
The meta episode.
The very meta episode. We talked a shitload about it on our X-Files episode.
Of
Laser Time a few weeks ago.
We did like a 7 best like gimmicky weird episodes that didn't rely on the lore so much. But
yeah. And this was the first one of those that was really big. Like the really big, and well, not even big, but just so appreciated that it is that... It's kind of a I guess Rashomon type episode where an alien abduction event happened, and instead of you Mulder and Scully looking into it, it is Charles Nelson Reilly talking to them about doing it and about the investigation and interviewing them for a book.
Multiple people's perspectives on the same thing, and no one saw it the same way.
Yeah.
And everyone's missing a piece of information or remembers something a special way. So it's like
Rashomon.
Scully remembers Mulder being a total dick to her, and Mulder remembers Scully being just, you know, like, oh my God, Mulder, shut up.
Well, and they also, when they're telling the story, like they get away with swearing in it because a sheriff guy, he says like motherfucker, but he just says, they bleep it out, or they change the word.
He says bleep. He's like, man, the bleep's really going to hit the fan.
Bleeps, yeah. Like, then it cuts back to Scully telling the story, and he's like, he had very colorful language.
He's like, oh yes, I met him. He had very colorful language. And Mulder never looks sadder than in this episode, too, where it ends, the last shot is Mulder in bed eating sunflower seeds and watching the Bigfoot hoax video just on a loop. in his bed. It's just so sad. And
that is my worst nightmare.
Alex Trebek, Jesse Ventura are in this episode as well.
Alex Trebek.
Yeah. It is so good. Chris, if you were to watch one episode of X-Files in the next week, Jose Chung's From Outer Space, one to watch.
So season three episode is one of the best.
Your boy Chrissy doesn't watch anything in standard definition anymore. What?
No, they've HD-ified it. They HD-ified it and stretched it to widescreen. Though I kind of miss... In my head, I remember it as a box. I don't like the stretch. It's same with The Wire.
No,
I saw The Wire as a box. They framed it for a box.
Those black bars on the side of your TV are important for the composition.
The Wire is different.
The Wire is different.
The thing Chris likes is different, everybody.
No, The Wire, they recropped.
Yeah.
It's amazing what they did with HDifying The Wire. I don't think any show will get that treatment.
And so, 2 days later on Fox, April 14th, 22 short films about Springfield.
Oh,
now,
that's awesome.
I skip over Simpsons things all the time on here because this is not talking Simpsons. We have a whole
other
show.
Devoted to that.
But this is probably the best season 8 episode there was.
Love this.
They're most ambitious. I only got one scene from it that I think is.
Oh, yeah.
Some folk will never raise dirt, but then again, some folks will. Like Cletus, the slack-jawed yokel.
Hey, what's going on this side? Hey, Brandine, you might could wear these to your job interview.
it's the idea where the Simpsons cast has got to the point where you don't even have to rely on the Simpsons to hold an episode, and you can show a slice of life. These little vignettes from every character they've ever animated. Not every single one, but
to that point, it showed...
It's a lot, yeah.
The Simpsons take a backseat more than they ever did before.
The steamed hams thing.
The Aurora Borealis.
Dave wrote an article for LaserTime a few years ago ranking every story in 22 short stories about Springfield. And that one, the... Aurora Borealis.
At this time of the year. At this
part of the country. Localized within your kitchen.
Yes.
Yes.
Can I
see it?
Skinner and the Superintendent. And I just Googled it to find the article on our website. And it 22 short films autofills to about Springfield.
Wow.
And not about the name it's parodying.
No.
It's Glenn Gould, right?
Yes. Yeah. And it has the steamed hams one. It has all the Pulp Fiction parodies in it too.
Find something comical about my automobile.
This was the largest automobile I could afford.
Everybody laugh at him.
God, this episode is so good.
Wiggum and Snake were almost brutally raped in a dungeon. That's the framing device.
I condemn you to scrolling
through the article.
We should re-promote that because it's 20 years old this week.
It is 20 years old. It's a great episode that still in my mind is recent Simpsons.
But we do have a whole show that is not too dissimilar from 302010, in which we each week talk about the next episode of The Simpsons going chronologically. But other thing that happened this week, we don't yet have an SNL dedicated show, but I'm sure it's in the works.
That's even stupider than doing The Simpsons.
The Simpsons are good. SNL has a very hit and miss range. But so get this, guys. A very rich man is running to be the GOP nominee for president, and he is going to host Saturday Night Live.
Oh, who could this man be?
Steve
Brought in by 7 Mario Kart 8s being played at once. So this is his monologue, I guess?
Yeah, it's his monologue.
Who's this guy?
Maybe hear his intro just real quick here.
Man, the people having the faint interest in this.
Even his dumb turtle face.
All right.
You can watch, see how often he blinks.
Very little.
Hello, human children.
Thank you.
Looks like Colbert in a suit wearing another man's face.
It has been a hectic last few months. As many of you may know, I was campaigning for the Republican nomination for the presidency of the United States.
And with that kind of charisma, how did he lose?
He got the whole line out.
But you probably don't want to hear about the campaign right now, because I'm sure a lot of you at home are busy filling out your federal income tax returns, which are due on Monday.
Mundy.
Filling out page after page.
Flat tax was his big thing.
Paid forms.
Laborious process.
His politically incorrect told me at the time his flat tax plan was his big deal, that taxes are too complicated. Everybody should pay the exact same tax.
Why? 17%, I believe.
17%.
17%.
Yes. Of just whatever you made.
Yeah.
Strangely, this billionaire favored rich people. Yeah. Anyway, he is the namesake of Forbes magazine.
Well, his dad is, really.
Okay, yes, sure.
You would know them now for their award-winning video game content.
And their great articles about why Superman should kill people. Great stuff. and so he was just a dweeb, and it's just a... You've never watched this episode. Like, it is a boring, bad episode of the show. Like, he makes, like, Wayne Gretzky look like a good comedian.
What is this, Dennis Miller?
He makes a little old Fauntleroy, babe. Bernard Shaw wouldn't...
Let's do something else.
But it also... They had counter-programming on it, too, which they would do at the time with political people. They had Rage Against the Machine, musicians in 1996.
I don't want to watch the episode. I just want to see green screen... Or the green room footage, man. Yeah.
Well, show you that either, because... Believe it or not, Rage Against the Machine had problems with authority on this show. So they got to play their first song. Their second song, they surprised Lorne Michaels with the news that on their speakers, they were going to have the American flag upside down as a sign of surrender and protest to having Steve Forbes on the show. Mm-hmm. And they said, before they were about to perform... You're not performing anything, and you are not coming back ever. And they just did one song, and we're gone.
I did not know. I know a lot about SNL and Rage, and I've never heard that story.
And they were banned for life after that. And yeah, it was Tom Morello. He said he blamed it on NBC, just siding with the rich guys again. Like, boo, once more.
That's a weird thing to pull live.
But they weren't happy about it. Yeah, and so...
Man, if only I had a show to talk about this in depth every
week. I'm not doing it!
But Rage It, we could do one of just banned from TV shows and talk... This is brainstorming live on here. Anyway, point is, it was... He did... Yeah, Steve Forbes... I won't subject the listeners to his terrible... Terrible performance.
Oh, I've already closed the tab.
The worst one that I can recall is that... The joke was that he would be playing a roofer, a blue-collar roofer with two other characters, and just the ridiculousness of him saying stuff about being a roofer and talking about some hot dame or whatever. But again, his thing looks like nice compared to Trump's one. But it looks quaint compared to Trump's episode 20 years later.
He seemed like just a robot.
Yeah.
Programmed by aliens.
I know, and he was just another rich guy who was like, I could be president, and I'll be a Republican.
Yeah, can you relate to even rich people? You can't relate to anyone, can you? Yes. Sure I can. I will relate very well to them.
At the other party, I miss those questions.
You hate it when you lay eggs in your own chest? What am I talking about?
You know, I don't think this happens anymore, but I miss when those guys would go on, like, say, the Don Imus show and be asked, what does milk cost? Like, what would a gallon of milk cost? These people never know. Like, there was that funny story in 92 where they tried to get
talking about George Bush?
H.W. Bush look more human. They take him to a
grocery
store, and he had never seen a scanner before.
He had never seen a grocery store scanner, which have been around since I was born.
Yeah, it's sad times. Anyway, Steve Ford.
What is this exactly?
A weird, unblinking alien turtle man who decided he should be president. And he was beaten by Bob Dole. Like, people were more interested in Bob Dole.
It's odd how egotistical rich people always feel like they belong as a president. Anyway.
That'll take us out of the 1996 segment. Playing us out will be one of the songs from the Songs in the Key of Springfield album, since we just got done talking about 22 short films about Springfield. That particular album did release in... it released in 1997, but we just got done talking about one of my most favorite episodes of the show, and this album came out right when I was getting out of...
Way too late.
The show... Well, it was like the last season of the show that I was watching every single Sunday without fail in 97 through 98. But when we come back, it'll be what happened this week in 2006.
It may not surprise you, but all of us despise you. Please die and fry in hell. You rot.
Thomas's internet and all the ships at sea. This is Diana's Classic Corner, where we look back even further into the past this week in search of classic movies that are worth watching. For April 8th through 14th, let's see, 75 years ago this week, on April 11th, 1941, we got The Road to Zanzibar, the second of the Bob Hope, Bing Crosby Road pictures. You know, the first bunch of these are actually a lot of fun. I mean, they're cheesy, duh, but, yeah, I mean, they're still, like, they're fun. Little kids, especially, if they get over that it's black and white, they'll probably think it's pretty funny. They're like cartoons. We also have The Devil and Miss Jones, which is kind of an underrated film from 1941 with Gene Arthur and Charles Coburn. I thought it was pretty funny. It's a little more obscure, though. And 50 years ago this week, the 10th of April and the 14th of April, 1966, we got a two-shot from William One-Shot Bodine, one of the worst filmmakers of all time. First up, Jesse James meets Frankenstein's daughter, followed by Billy the Kid versus Dracula. These movies are amazing. If you've never heard of William One-Shot Bodine, he got that nickname because there weren't retakes. So if, oh, I don't know, part of the scenery fell over in the shot. So we're moving on. Keep going. He's like Clint Eastwood that way. Except Clint Eastwood never made a movie about Jesse James meeting Frankenstein's daughter. They are hilarious, and I totally recommend them. That's it for Classic Corner this week. Stay classic.
Here is a true story.
Of four friends picked to live in a video game.
And find out what happens when they stop being themselves.
And start being someone else.
Animal Crossing for Nintendo GameCube.
A walrus moved into the village today. Hot.
I just been fishing, you know, seeing some pals.
All Rob does is fish. Fish and see his pals. I'm the one getting the job, attending the
Welcome to Animal Crossing, the light game that's happening every minute of every day, whether you're playing or not.
Hey! It's called a lawnmower. Other people have to live here too, you know.
Rated E for everyone.
Where is the moment we need it the most? You kick up the leaves and the magic is lost. Tell me your blue skies fade to gray. Tell me your passion's gone away, and I don't need no care or none.
Okay, bringing us into two. You guys wanted to do 2006 segment. I wanted to call the show 3020.
I have not heard that song other than used ironically in like Vines and Instagrams.
Dude, this song is most known for me for mascot fail compilations of raptors eating shit on rollerblades.
Yeah, or like Kentucky girls getting hit in the head with shovels.
Yeah.
Daniel
Powder, Bad Day is number one.
This no week, clue the name
this
of this
ends
person.
Up being the best performing single of the year.
Whoa, really?
2006. Three times platinum in the US and Australia, gold in UK and Germany. But yeah, wow. I mostly know it for like
this guy beat Beyonce.
Yeah. Put over, yeah, like it's just
such a stupid song.
The amount of a, but you can. This is one of those songs though. It's just like this can be on any station that's played in a dentist in a lobby anywhere.
It's
and
not rock. It's not quite jazz.
Everyone can go like, I've had a bad day.
I know what that's like.
There's an Alvin and the Chipmunks version you can listen to.
But I wouldn't listen to it.
But it was a self-titled studio debut album in 2005, but the song Bad Day tearing up the charts this week. We also got a new album from Pretty Girls Make Graves, who I mostly know for NXT wrestlers slash now permanent commentary. Because he got injured. Graves?
Corey Graves!
I'm pretty sure he mentioned one of his tattoos is a reference to Pretty Girls Make Graves.
Cute. Losing Diana here.
And I'm wondering if that's where his, name came from. LL Cool J, new album. Toby Keith, the new album.
Yeah.
And a Queen compilation album called Stone Cold Classics, which was a tie... Which was a tie-in with American Idol, and I guess the episode that week of American Idol was all, like, mostly Queen covers.
Didn't an American Idol contestant end up being the front man for Queen?
I think Adam Lambert did.
Yeah, Adam Lambert did for a little while.
He did some shows with Queen. He toured with them. Queen, yay. American Idol, boo.
Yeah.
But,
and we just did a Laser Time about, because American Idol's over now.
Mm-hmm.
And we just did a Laser Time about the reality TV show RIP, like 1992 to.
I think it's a fun episode, guys. Tell me the same on the internet. I don't want to hear if you didn't like it.
I only want the echo chamber that agrees with me. Movies this week, again, this is April 8th through the 14th. Ice Age The Meltdown is still number one. That Scrat, man, I tell you.
He's
a hoot. The only thing good about
him. I love him. He's the Roadrunner.
You know, he's voiced by the director, the original director of all the films.
Of Critters?
Of all the Ice Age films. Because that trailer came out before the movie had even started. So like, you thought the movie was about Scrat. The first trailer was the first Scrat cartoon.
Not Ray Romano. But anyway, I'm sure we talked all about this last week. So,
Scary Movie 4 is also out this week.
God
damn it.
Someone give Anna Faris better things to do.
Yeah.
She is so fucking great. Yeah. Like, she is so funny. And it is sad that she got, like, damned to be in these things. Just, it's the worst. That she was in it from the crossover. When the Wayans stopped working on it, she was still there. And they're just, Scary Movie began a factory of films that were just the easiest parodies you could possibly
make. They're not even parodies. They're just reference. And they're
like,
a reference.
They're like trailer mashups.
Mashups for made as cheaply as possible, aimed at the lowest common denominator possible. And at the very least, the original Scary Movie at least was the most obscene. Like, it was like, this is the most disgusting R-rated thing ever. At least they had that going for it. But these were like, we got to get it PG-13 for dumb kids.
Was this the one that, like, started in with Charlie Sheen and, like, it was like majorly a War of the Worlds parody.
And also Marlon Brando. No, that was a early one with Marlon Brando.
And I think that was the second one, and he never did that. I think they replaced him with, like, Chris Elliott or something.
I thought he was a dude.
Chris Elliott is in this one. Molly Shannon, Michael Madsen, Kevin Hart, Patrice O'Neill.
Oh, all right.
Anna Faris, Regina Hall, Leslie Nielsen as President Harris, Bill Pullman.
Oh.
You want to see Anna Faris being hilarious? Observe and report. I hope that movie comes up on this.
She's got her own podcast now.
Does she?
It's funny that she's on the level of, like, she was used to be more famous than Chris Pratt. Now Chris Pratt is like triple as famous as she used to be. The only other thing I remember of Scary Movie is the great point it makes in its existence. Of the first one makes a great point in this film is not yet rated, because he shows back to back of, here's a scene that got NC-17 rating. This woman's just enjoying having oral sex done to her too much. That's NC-17. Yep. Cut to Anna Faris being glued to the ceiling by a hose of cum.
Yeah. I saw the movie on a date. It was the first
hose of cum movie?
Yeah, it was the first date. It was.
Oh.
It's actually a true story. But this first Scary Movie always rubbed me the wrong way, because it came out the week before the first X-Men movie. Mm-hmm. So I was watching them very intently, the box office, of like, please let the first X-Men beat Scary Movie. Because if X-Men tanked, there would not, like, that was it. That was the grand experiment of, like, okay, we're going to try to make you guys a real comic book movie with characters, and they're going to use their powers, and they're going to be called their goofy names. If this doesn't make money, there's not going to be a Spider-Man movie, and then it's over. So every week I was like, please, just beat the movie that's just making fun of Scream. Like, can you please just do that? Because even these Scary Movies, you can... In the movie, the first one, I don't remember it that well, but I guess...
It's unmemorable.
It was at least like a more, like, we're going to make fun of Scream with sprinkled other references in here. But by the time, Scary Movie 4, the poster is Peter Jackson's King Kong, War of the Worlds, Saw... The Grudge, Shaq is on the cover. It's just like, what happened last year?
And that was all of those, every blank movie after it was that way of just, here's a poster with every joke we're doing in this. Yeah. So you'll know you'll know what we're making fun of.
Are these tied into the, like, Epic Movie and none of the teen movie?
Well, yeah, Dreiberg, what are the names?
Parents who are major producers.
Actually,
and allow
they
them
weren't
to
writers on
movies.
This. We had Dreiberg and some other, a couple of Jews.
Seltzerberg and... Freiberg, I think.
Yeah, they're garbage makers. They make the worst garbage ever. But they kind of took over the franchise because they said, are the Wayans too expensive for you? We can do it.
Yeah, I feel like around Scary Movie 3 or 4 is the one where it started to be like, from the producers of Scary Movie 2, from the studio that brought you Scary Movie 1.
The studio.
It's like, oh, this is bad.
You know, in Meet the Spartans, the most famous person they got in it was... The guy in Borat who chases him naked.
Kevin Sorbo? No, yeah, I know who you're talking about.
Yeah.
God, meet the Spartans.
That guy.
Anyway.
Also out this week, Disney's CG movie, The Wild.
I didn't watch that because it looked like Disney was trying to make a garbage DreamWorks film.
Yeah.
Well, it looked like they are distributing a movie from another territory.
Sure,
I can't confirm that.
Kiefer
because
Sutherland.
They really kept this low-key and did not market
film. I've heard that this and Madagascar have a lot in common. Mm-hmm. I'm blanking on which came first.
The film was a core feature animation Walt Disney production distributed by Buena Vista.
Never mind.
Oh, and it's called
they buried it.
When it's a Buena Vista production, that means don't watch
it. It just seemed like one of those Romeo and Juliet.
Ugh.
That turkey.
Or Wizard of Oz 2 or whatever. those bad things.
But yeah, Variety described it as ultimately done in by the persistent stench of been there, but done that because of 2005 film Madagascar.
So it couldn't, man.
That's tough, though. I mean, especially if you're making an animated movie and then, like, you know, you're 80% done and another movie comes out this week.
You can't course correct into a different film.
Really, you got to just shelve it for 4 years. But
all those CG movies, by the way, are like
so long.
A gang of X has to get back to Y.
Yeah.
That is everything. That is all of them the time.
Toy Story invented it and then everybody just did it.
The tagline for the movie is "Start spreading the newspaper."
What?
Because they're animals. Pee on the
they're
going to
pee and poop everywhere.
Oh, I don't care.
But Eddie Izzard, William Shatner, Kiefer Sutherland.
These were dark times.
Yes. I'd rather just see them hanging out. That sounds amazing.
I'd rather hear that podcast than watch that movie.
Put them in a room for 2 hours, film it.
I will pay you $10 to listen to that. TV this week, anything but what we just talked about.
pretty low times for TV. Well, not really. But Jeremy Piven's Journey of a Lifetime airs on April 8th, which was basically, can you film me taking a vacation? I'm Jeremy Piven.
Are you kidding?
And it's about him going, it's even more pretentious because he goes to, India and areas like that to find his spiritualism really speaks to him.
No.
Yes. Yep.
No.
It's
that
disgusting.
Is always the worst thing that happens to anyone is anytime like a millionaire decides to get spiritual also film it and tell you about it.
Yep.
Tom Shadyac, that dipshit who directed Bruce Almighty and a bunch of really horrible movies. He had some sort of accident and then he decided to make a documentary about like how he gave everything away and he's really spiritual now. It's like, can't you just do that? Do you have to tell me about it? I don't care. I have my own problems. Give me your millions of dollars if you want to cleanse your soul.
The money and time you spent on telling me about this could have been spent more on charity.
Yeah, how about buy sandwiches for everyone in town?
Also, part two, the all-important part two, South Park Cartoon Wars.
Talked
about South Park not too long ago, the Final Chef episode, but the war between Family Guy and South Park and the war over drawing Muhammad or not, they're kind of still important today, 10 years later, both of them, honestly.
They mentioned,
especially Family Guy.
In the clip, in that episode, they mentioned not being able to show Muhammad.
Yeah, which they could do 3 years earlier on their David Blaine Super Friends parody episode. Mm-hmm. Muhammad just was a member of the team. Nobody knew it was a controversial thing to draw Muhammad. When I say nobody, I mean mainstream America did not know that that was a thing you're not supposed to do.
Not going to say anything because this is the most I've ever gotten yelled at.
But anyway, that's what the episode was about. But to me, it was about calling out Family Guy for not being good. Yeah. And they were correct.
I do love this.
They kind of take it from both sides. They did have a guy show up who says, I like Family Guy. It's not up its own ass with preachiness like this show. Yeah. And then I just want to watch something at the end of the day.
The only reason I felt that is I was like hitting on a college girl when I was like 24 at a college party.
Ooh.
And she's and I'm like, yeah, I like animation. She's like, oh, I love animation. But I only watch Family Guy. I'm like, I like Family Guy, but that's gross. That's disgusting, and I hate you.
What's the status of your hair at that point?
What?
Do you have, frosted tips or...
Oh, God, I might have had the long hair at that
Capri
point.
Capri pants. I'm just trying to place you in
probably
2004.
Atlanta Braves hat.
Well, and so they introduce the idea of, in the first part, they talk about how it's seemingly unoriginal Family Guy. And this was their amazing explanation that has stuck with me to this day why the show is so disposable.
Family Guy is written by manatees? Of course. It all makes sense now.
They really are brilliant creatures. You see, the right side of the tank is filled with idea balls. Each idea ball has a verb, noun, or pop culture reference written on it. There's millions of them. The manatees choose an idea ball and swim it over to the joke combine on the other side of the tank. But there goes Gretchen. She's coming up with an idea. Oh, she came up with Gary Coleman. The idea balls drop into the joke combine and form a part of the new script. Laundry, date, winning, Mexico, Gary Coleman. A perfect Family Guy joke. I can see it now.
Peter, you didn't do the laundry today.
You think that's bad? Remember the time I won a date to Mexico with Gary Coleman?
¿Qué pasó, señores? What you talking about, Willis?
Yep. Yep. God
that,
damn.
I understand that, but isn't it weird that this criticism of Family Guy has looped around to being irrelevant?
Yeah. I mean, people because, stopped like, caring about it.
Because they've made such an art out of the cutaway. Like, it's really funny. It's become even funnier because there's jokes about having cutaways now.
Yeah, I mean, the show isn't the worst show ever. I famously had a very heated thing in our old show about how much
now.
I hated it. There are good people that work on it who are talented writers and performers.
Because they're good jokes.
But it is just
There are some good jokes.
If you do 8,000 jokes that are free association.
Just because
yes.
you don't like how something is funny doesn't make it not funny.
Yeah.
You just don't respect it.
I don't respect it. Absolutely don't.
Didn't respect Ernest that much either when you're little. Fight!
No, I liked Ernest, but anyway, it was nice to... I enjoyed seeing Family Guy get shit on by South Park, though they also talked about how Simpsons wasn't as biting as it used to be, and that meanwhile King of the Hill is just cool and they're going to leave it alone. Like, they walked through the animation studio of King of the Hill... just to basically say, and King of the Hill does exist. We like it and don't have any problems. Like, and
it is weird. It was so long ago. Like they're now like friends now, and I think they go on retreats and they tweet at one another because like there is no grudge. They say there was never grudge with the South Park writers and Family Guy writers. Yes, there was.
Yeah.
Yes, there was. You made a two-part... This is the first South Park two-part episode. Like, an original plot that couldn't be resolved in one episode because they write this fucking show in 6 days. And now they do it all the time, and it's amazing.
But yeah, this is weird because it is like Bart walking around with Cartman, right?
Yeah.
And
I love...
Because they team up because Simpsons they both hate Family Guy.
Simpsons did it.
Speaking of Fox shows, April 14th was the final airing of the Bernie Mac show, which which aired for 104 episodes.
I really liked that show.
From the beginning, it took, like most good stand-up comedians shows, it took a premise from one of their jokes and turned it into a series where he adopts his
not a joke that happened to Bernie.
Well, but I'm just saying he talked about adopting these kids, sister's kids, adopts them and raises them, and
she's got a rehab.
I remember his joke about he's diabetic, he got sugar in the blood. He's talking about to get some milk and cookies. the effeminate son of his.
I saw the first episode on like WGN when I was at my parents' house. And just from the first episode, it's like, don't keep your hands off my album, don't touch my soul records, and keep your hands off my happy rap. And then just a little hand points like kid and play.
Yeah.
My happy rap. That's section. I've never heard happy rap.
I love that on the show that they would have just like yellow writing on the screen. To point at things just for quick little jokes. It made him feel more like an animated series in a way. And the Bernie Mac's character of Bernie Mac was just such an interesting dude who he kind of was I think he was almost a Hank Hill type in that he was had an old school mentality trying to fit with the real world of today.
Sure, somebody would find it offensive, his threat to bust your head to the white meat shows.
Yeah. But in him also, like, it was about, you know, it was kind of about race, but it was about bringing people together, too. It was him and his black family, but he would have white people on it all the time, and it was about uniting people.
I think he originated, like, the poker scene, just to, like, quickly and cheaply get points across and have a conversation with people of multiple different backgrounds.
It's a really underrated show.
And Bernie Mac is the only funny thing about Chris Rock's head of state.
Yes.
I love Bernie Mac so very much. I can't believe we lost him.
Human Puppeteer, Bernie Mac.
That's the saddest part about it, that the last Bernie Mac performance is Old Dogs.
Wasn't he in that film with Samuel L. Jackson that came out? Soul Man?
Yeah.
I can't remember which came out first. But
Old Dogs was delayed like 2 years.
Yes, because everybody in it kept dying, or like they John Travolta's son died, Jet, and then Bernie Mac died. Yeah.
Is this a trailer that you gave me? Or?
No, this.
I ain't scared of you motherfuckers.
Yeah. So I want to talk about just Bernie Mac a little bit too.
I love Bernie Mac.
He dies 2 years after this, sadly.
I got no idea what the clip was.
Though. Okay, so yeah, Bernie Mac. The show was created by Larry Whitmore too, but what I didn't watch Def Comedy Jam. I didn't have HBO when Def Comedy Jam was on.
I watched Midnight Mac on HBO.
I did know Bernie Mac from the original Kings of Comedy, mm-hmm. and then all four of those guys got TV shows mm-hmm. after that. Like, yeah. Though I guess Cedric later got his own TV show, but he was also just a co-star on Steve Harvey's show, mm-hmm. and then yeah. But anyway, Bernie Mac. His arrival on the national stage was an episode of Def Comedy Jam on HBO where the audience was extra, extra rowdy and no comedian could control them or to get them to like listen. And then he comes out, says,
"Next big dude,"
and says, "I ain't scared of y'all motherfuckers."
"I ain't scared of you motherfuckers. I'm going to tell you something straight off the motherfucking press. I ain't coming for no foolishness. In New York, goddamn it, y'all motherfucking women look good. Y'all like a bacon and egg sandwich look good. But I love sex. I love it. Can't do shit no more. And I'm blessed."
He's talking about his dick.
Oh! Jesus, Hank.
Dick. I'm big boned. I'm heavy structured. I'm hung low. If I pull my shit out, this whole room get dark.
And then he plays fucking music. Like, all right, stop. It's got to cut it. Watch that whole stand-up thing. It's one of the best stand-up routines ever filmed. I miss him. I didn't realize how much I missed him until I watched
Bernie
this
Mac.
Stuff.
Like, I, just have
I know
this
you're
on...
cringing at my impression, but that comes from like pure joy. I watched him for years. Had trouble understanding him on Midnight Mac. HBO gave him like a weird... show of like his local
that.
Comic show called Midnight Mac. It didn't last for very long, but
I just got to keep this on standby.
I ain't scared of you motherfuckers.
If you remember our slam jams from Talk Radio, that was the sound effect.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's directly from Def Comedy Jam.
No, I.
There's an Indian burial ground hidden in your copy of Iron Man.
The only other thing I'll say about the Bernie Mac show is that it's easy to watch because nobody cares to take it off YouTube at all. Like, not even it's the regular YouTube tricks to keep the episodes on there. It's just, this is the full episode with nothing around it. Like, watch it or don't, man.
That's the weird thing about every HBO show before Oz was kind of licensed from somebody else. But HBO is also a co-owner. They can't agree on when to release them, syndicate them, show them. Ever again. I think they just said Gary Shandling had finally reached a deal
really?
With HBO to put them back on. It's hard-coded into the show. HBO presents, but it is a Sony show.
Wow.
But that did not happen ever again after Oz. But like, you cannot find Larry Sanders anywhere. It doesn't exist. It barely is out on DVD. love that show.
Right.
That's why I stole it.
R.I.P. Bernie.
That wraps up for TV for this week in 2006. Video games, one quick note, because it's so bizarre, Odama came out for the GameCube.
Huh?
This game is called...
I voted for him.
I know. So this is the merely... So at this point, I'd already voted for Obama in Illinois, thank you, before he was running for president. But Odama is a GameCube... pinball battle game that you play with Donkey Kong bongo controller.
Oh, yeah.
Like a feudal...
A battle, yes.
Like a feudal Japan-looking battle game with armies, but it's played like a giant pinball game.
Oh, my God.
And
it's really bizarre.
And I don't know. I played it a lot then and then didn't play it for like 10 years. Well, now literally 10 years. Yep. But it was such a... Just one of those, like, guys, the GameCube is in its last legs. This is not the game that's going to help you not be on your last legs.
You can't do this anywhere else.
But it was like, no one has a peripheral that's going to make this make sense.
Diana interested in a video game.
It is one
Diana,
of these
I couldn't
strangest...
afford to buy you a drum for your birthday, but how about a nice set of bongos?
I think we have some around the house already, actually.
Yeah, I still have my...
I'm sure we do.
I'm certain
somewhere.
You have a
cup. There's like a closet of peripheral crap.
There's certainly a Donkey Konga.
There's a bunch of different guitars, and there's Samba de Amigo maracas, I'm sure there.
I bet
yeah.
if you spray-painted Michael's boy room gray, it would look like the Mystery Science Theater 2000 set. Oh, snap! Stop talking about.
But also this week, Tomb Raider Legend. Tomb Raider Legend, which is the first time Tomb Raider had a hard stop, and like everything before that didn't happen. Crystal Dynamics took over after Angel of Darkness, which was the original developer Core trying to like that. Even Angel of Darkness was them trying to get back to basics, or like we're gonna get Lara Croft back on track. Mm-hmm. And that game absolutely did not do that. It was real bad.
They had to get it out in time for a movie, and so
we have streamed it. It is. Yeah. Fucking terrible.
Yeah, I reviewed it back in 2003. It was not fun
Tomb
then.
Tomb Raider, horribly paced, and it's like you're stuck at outside of a building for like an hour.
It takes so it's just like no concessions in for like modern game development. And for what it's worth, it was a kind of game that needed to just not exist for 4 or 5 years while everyone else figured out how to do 3D navigation, move cameras well, while also being able to traverse environments vertically and horizontally.
They
like
they
it just
nail
needed
it with Legends.
Yeah, Legend
so,
came
Legend.
Out great.
Legend,
yeah. So they hired the dude. Due to the folks who did Gex to
and
make
Pandemonium, lest we forget,
In their local company, their Bay Area developer, Crystal Dynamics, and some fans were ready to reject it and be like, "I don't Crystal Dynamics, they're not Core. Eidos is going to screw this up."
Yeah,
and what they made was a totally good 8 out of 10 game. It's a really fine game. It felt like it was definitely a reboot. It was like, this looks better, plays well,
yeah,
and it's just about her exploring place again. We're gonna drop you in a crazy cavern and walk around.
I think it might be the most multi-platform game of all time.
This
Played
is
on
one
Wii, GameCube, PS2, dude. Xbox, PSP.
What?
I think it was re-released at 360.
This was.
Oh my god!
There's a Game Boy Advance and DS versions. They're not the same, obviously, but like, yeah, this is one of those games that 10 years ago, like we mentioned a few episodes ago, we're at Games Radar. Now the site is live at this point, and this is one of those previews that like it was like, yeah, we got to write a preview for a PS2, original Xbox, 360. PSP versions coming. There's a GameCube one.
Try and write different previews for all platforms.
Because back then there were different editors, so it's like, you're the Xbox guy, you're the Nintendo guy. Yeah, and I still have the GameCube one because it's at one point it was considered rare because it came out kind of after the fact and is one of the last GameCube games released like right before Twilight Princess even. Mm-hmm. So, I don't know. My memories for this game are really tied up in like finally having a salary games job and then why is every story every day about Tomb Raider Legend? Because there's so many versions that every time they send screenshots, it's like, well, I guess we got to post all the screenshots for 7 versions of this game.
Well, the games press has really changed. Yeah. But it was a real good game. 2 years later, you know, they put out the Underworld sequel and it didn't squander. I wouldn't say it squandered what it did, but it wasn't. It didn't build on it a ton.
Yeah.
Where
was the anniversary in there?
We made more of it
this was
in between.
This is the 10th anniversary of the series, and then they did Tomb Raider Anniversary, which was a remake of the first Tomb Raider, which I've still kept because I want to play that someday.
It's good.
I bought a package of all of them on Steam for super cheap.
Well, I don't want all.
Always
of them.
On sale.
I don't want all.
Yeah, they also put it on the 360, that one as well. And then, you know, Underworld was fine, though they also had that one problem of, do you want to see the end of the game? How about buy DLC? Like, that was the year people were experimenting that. And then Uncharted came along and was like, we're a better Tomb Raider. We're Dude Raider. And so then leading to 2013, them having to reboot Tomb Raider again, but with Crystal D as simply Tomb Raider. And it was a very good game in the post-Uncharted world. Now it just feels like they're just kind of trading things like Tomb Raider and Tomb Raider inspires Uncharted. Uncharted inspires Tomb Raider.
Yeah.
And now it feels like Tomb Raider is inspiring Uncharted again. I guess we'll know when Uncharted 4 eventually releases.
$6.99 on Steam if you care.
Gotcha. Yeah, it's totally competent game, but it is one of those weird, like, this isn't the status quo anymore, so why play it now? Like, it's really hard to recommend this over, say, Anniversary, which got to take some of the strides made in Legend and apply them to the original Tomb Raider, which is what started it all. So, like, I would still kind of push people to that one, I guess, if I was going to say play one from this era. But Legend, it was just at the time, it was nice to, because I take games seriously as, like, wanting them to live on and be treated, like, somewhat seriously. So when a series that was popular really flies off the rails and gets bad reviews and just has a shitty reputation and it's clear it's not where it was, it's just kind of sad because you're like, oh, this big thing. It's like, if there's like eight shitty Bond movies in a row that tank, and you're like, oh, is this it? Is this big thing that everybody we were all into, is it now over? Or like, this band isn't going to make any more music, and I guess that thing we all loved is over. And so when Tomb Raider could kind of come back with Legend, it was like, I don't play many of these games, but it's nice to know that maybe there's some hope. And then Underworld didn't really build on it. But it did sell 4 million copies, so they did their
job. I mean, none of them were as bad as the three Tomb Raider games that preceded it.
There was three.
Last Revelation.
Three
wasn't great.
Last Revelation, Chronicles, and then Angel of Darkness was
so
the...
With all these with it being on so many different consoles, were there any differences between them?
There's actually strangely a section in here, differences between versions. Because
Are we talking like super minor stuff or?
Yeah, there's going to be minor things. Like the GBA one obviously is just a completely different game.
They looked great on the Dreamcast, terrible on the PlayStation.
Yeah, so like it says here, the original Xbox version does not include the introduction movie with the opening title. The PSV, PSP version has lower polygon count and the textures are reduced. The GameCube version has demos that don't play, and I mean, but like largely they're the same game across the consoles. Yeah. Then when you get into handhelds, PSP could handle a very watered down version, whereas the DS one is like, this is a completely different thing that we're not even going to try to do a 3D world in and all that. Mm-hmm. But I guess 360 was really the lead. Like, this is the one you got to play.
Yeah, I mean, the 360 wasn't even a year old yet, and here's the first, like...
And there was no there was no PS3, so...
It's a major third-party game when the first to come out on it, yeah.
Yeah. That brings us to the end of the show, everybody. Thanks for listening.
Oh, whoa.
No, not yet. Okay. Chris. You're keeping your pants. damn it, I closed the tab with Bernie Mac in it. But yeah, thanks for listening. 302010, please give us a rating and a review on iTunes. All the rates and ratings and reviews help push us in the charts. You can find more on lasertimepodcast.com, which is where the page for this site, the podcasts are each week. So if you want to comment, tell us what you thought of the episode. If something happened to you, somebody
ask me to never impersonate Bernie Mac ever again.
Yeah, I meant to have this queued up. Someone in the comments was like, "Hey, this week was my birthday, so here's what I did each of those weeks." And the 86 one was like, "Was not yet conceived." But fun stuff like that. Like, what were you doing in this week? If any of these things strike a chord with you,
96 was a POW.
But yeah, things like that are fun. I also do a video game music podcast called VG Empire, which is look at the soundtracks to video games. Been doing it for 4 years, so check out VGEmpire.com for all kinds of if you can name a soundtrack or a franchise, odds are we've done it and are still doing it.
And Laser Time, baby, if you like, let's just say Diana, she will be on an upcoming episode where you've prepared a quiz on names, and that's I'll say, depending on when this releases. And we also have a look at reality shows, and what was this?
Florida was Florida. Pretty great, too. I love my Florida episode.
Our buddy
Fuck
Mike Drucker.
Florida.
Florida forever.
Fuck Florida.
There's also Talking Simpsons, the exploration of every episode of The Simpsons one at a time, into season 3 now with our good bro Bob Mackey on it. Also, I do Cape Crisis, the comic book podcast. If you want to hear me talk about why Wonder Woman's great and the Batman vs. Superman films are a crime against cinema and Superman, give it a listen. And let me also mention, like, guys, you should follow us at Lasertime Show on Twitter and like the page for Laser Time on Facebook, because that's where you're going to find out about all the stuff we're doing. I don't say this enough, but you know, follow us. We do cool stuff on there.
Mm-hmm. Yep, stuff like Video Game Apocalypse, which is the video game show that my husband hosts. Yeah, this is why we never see each other, because you know we can't be on the same podcast.
One of you is here, and the other one's
at home. It's like Time Cop. If we get too close, and we like explode.
Finally, someone explained a marriage using Time Cop.
This all makes so much sense now.
I'm also on Twitter at listenanerd.com. No, I almost say .com every single time. Wow. At listenanerd,
spelled LAY sinner.
And then heard, like you heard with purred. Yep. That brings us to the way we end every episode. Home Movies, the birthday song, will narrate. Jesus, every week it's so loud. Birthdays, April 8th to the 14th. Kristen Stewart, Daisy Ridley. Goldust is 46, Henry. Wow.
Dustin Runnels?
Yes. Sarah Michelle
Gellar.
Kane Hodder, famous Jason Voorhees, is 60 years old. David Letterman, Shannon Doherty, Claire Danes, Adrian Brody, Anthony Michael Hall.
cold.
And now for the quiz.
Have you seen Santa Claus, David Letterman?
Yeah, I was just going to ask that. No. What he looks like now that he doesn't give a fuck?
Oh, yes, I did see him with his beard. Yes,
he shaved it all off his head. And
I love that he's just like, I'm not on TV, fuck it.
He looks like that elder dude from Dragon Ball.
Let's get that quiz.
The quiz, though, this week. Elder dude from Dragon Ball.
I don't know his fucking name.
Master Roshi. Jesus. 8th to the 14th. Born 1973.
Okay.
First actor under 30 to win Best Actor.
Richard Dreyfuss?
No. I realize I may have actually said his name.
You said his name then. Adrian Brody.
It is Adrian Brody.
Because he's the youngest person to win Best Actor now.
Is he really?
He is. Yeah, he's 29.
For the penis?
Yeah,
what a turd, man. Well, he'll never be as young as Anna Paquin, though. So,
man, you know you'll never be.
Anna Paquin will never be as young as Tatum O'Neill. Boom,
you got me.
Thanks for listening. You can find us every week, every Thursday on Laser Time Network or on iTunes. Taking us out, we mentioned at the beginning of the episode, at the beginning of 2006 segments, the Queen compilation, Stone Cold Classics. It's the shittiest Stone Cold impression.
How many greatest hits album did they have to revert to that?
I don't know. Well, this is before Stunning Steve Austin took the term from them. But we're going to go out with...
One Hope, One True Religion.
What about Queen?
You guys get away with so much wrestling this time,
all
right?
We talked about the least amount of all the topics in pop culture.
Doesn't matter.
I Want It All by Queen. We'll see you next time.